Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. I hope you've had a great week so far. In this podcast, I'm going to talk a little bit about lifting equipment and their role in exercise. Specifically, do lifting belts help? And if so, how? What about wrist wraps? Are they really going to improve your bench press or grip strength? Do knee sleeves help with the squat? And just how much does popping an ammonia cap improve performance? For each piece of equipment, I'll summarize how they're supposed to work, whether or not they do, and give some practical recommendations around use. For those in the market for lifting gear, I've also linked all the stuff that I talk about here in the show notes. All that and more on this episode of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Let's start out with lifting belts. Now, lifting belts are thought to allow someone to lift more weight or do more reps and maybe reduce the risk of injury to the low back by three major mechanisms. One is by increasing the intra-abdominal pressure, that's the pressure within your abdominal cavity, increasing muscle activity of the core or trunk muscles, and maybe even by doing the job of those trunk or core muscles. Some people call this a potential crutch. Let's address each one of these briefly. Starting out with intra-abdominal pressure, this is the force that's created within the abdomen, and it varies based on both the respiratory phase, so whether you're breathing in or out, and the abdominal wall's resistance, so how much those muscles are contracting. In humans, the intra-abdominal pressure goes up when we breathe in as the diaphragm contracts and descends, thereby reducing the space within the abdominal cavity. Smaller space, increased pressure. Now, if we take a breath and hold it like we do during a Valsalva maneuver, the intra-abdominal pressure goes up even more, as the combination of holding our breath and the added muscular tension from the abdominal wall muscles, well, that decreases the volume of the intra-abdominal cavity even further. Again, smaller space, increased pressure. Now, in healthy individuals, the average intra-abdominal pressure when standing upright is about 20 millimeters of mercury, and this increases to about 65 millimeters of mercury when performing a Valsalva maneuver. With respect to lifting weights, intra-abdominal pressure appears to be important as people reflexively hold their breath and increase their intra-abdominal pressure by performing a Valsalva maneuver, whether or not they mean to do it. This is more sort of a force production thing, force transfer thing. If you're trying to create force with your legs and you need to transfer it through your midsection or trunk, you're going to do a Valsalva maneuver when the weight or the effort is challenging. Still, those pressures we just talked about are far lower than what is seen during hard physical efforts like deadlifting 90% of your one rep max. Research shows that subjects had an average intra-abdominal pressure of about 156 millimeters of mercury without wearing a belt and 175 millimeters of mercury with a belt. Now, the majority of the available data shows that intra-abdominal pressure increases when using a belt, suggesting this is likely one of the mechanisms by which belts work. Let's move on to muscle activity. And when we talk about muscle activity, there are a number of trunk muscles that we're referring to in particular. Now, these are muscles that work in concert to manage movement, position, and rigidity through muscular force production. Now, to create muscular force, electric signals are carried by a nerve to the muscle that is supposed to contract. These electrical signals can be measured by what's known as surface electromyography, or SEMG, which uses an electrode placed on the muscle's surface, really on the skin, to capture the electrical activity going on underneath. Now, the electrical activity values measured by SEMG, or surface electromyography, indicate the level of excitation, with higher or lower levels indicating more or less excitation, respectively. The theory here is that greater SEMG amplitudes implies greater muscle excitation, which implies greater potential strength and hypertrophy responses, because the muscles are more active, though this remains yet to be proven. Now, another proxy for muscular activity is intramuscular pressure, which is the fluid pressure within the muscle itself. In general, when intramuscular pressure goes up, so does muscular force production. So when we look at the available data, it looks like trunk muscle activity isn't much different when using a belt compared to not using a belt. Practically speaking, this means that a belt is likely not causing the trunk muscles to function at a lower level or reducing the fitness adaptations incurred from lifting weights. In fact, direct tests of trunk muscle strength and endurance in workers using a belt for 2 to 3 months show that on average, muscular strength and endurance improved with regular belt use. All right, now for the big one, back pain and low back injury risk with belt usage. Now, low back pain is common with a lifetime risk of nearly 85% in the general population and 61% in athletes during the athletic career. While nearly 90% of gym goers who wear a belt claim that they do so to, quote, prevent injury, the existing evidence does not support this claim. We have multiple large, long-duration studies across multiple different industries that have repeatedly found the same thing. Belts do not reliably reduce the risk of low back injury, lost or restricted work days, or workmen's compensation claims due to low back injury. Ultimately, these repeatedly consistent findings led the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health to conclude, and I quote, "After a review of the scientific literature, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has concluded that, because of limitations of the studies that have analyzed workplace use of back belts, the results cannot be used to either support or refute the effectiveness of back belts in injury reduction." Now, that's the story of using a belt on the job, but we don't actually have any data showing that people who use a belt during resistance training have more or less injuries than those who don't use a belt. So that's still speculative at this point, but overall, we'd expect to see some sort of signal in the research showing a reduced risk of injury with belt usage across multiple different domains. Still, the use of a belt during activity may improve comfort and activity levels that people are able to or willing to participate in during active episodes of low back pain. Basically, if you have low back pain, using a belt may actually help you be more active and participate in exercise. Admittedly, this is mostly from my experience, both personally and professionally, but there's little data to back this up, so that is rather speculative. As an aside, most forms of resistance training have an injury rate of 2 to 4 injuries per 1,000 participation hours, which is relatively low compared to other non-contact sports and far lower than most contact sports. This includes specific training modalities like bodybuilding, powerlifting, Olympic weightlifting, and CrossFit. Unfortunately, the majority of injuries observed during resistance training are not catastrophic, in that they do not require specialized care and spontaneously resolve on their own with an average symptom duration of less than 2 weeks. Okay, now let's talk about lifting belts and performance. Unfortunately, there are no studies looking directly at whether or not people can lift more weight with a belt. However, there is evidence suggesting that people likely lift more weight with a belt than without. For example, one study measured the velocity that subjects could squat 90% of their one rep max with and without a belt. While the electrical activity of the erectors, hamstrings, glutes, and quadriceps muscles were no different with or without a belt, the subjects completed the rep about 15.5% faster on the way up when using a belt. There was also a trend towards an increased range of motion with a slight increase in squat depth. This suggests an improvement in force transfer from the primary movers, which are the legs, basically allowing the trunk to be a more efficient way to transfer force to the bar that's placed on the top of the back without compromising the range of motion. Now, these findings were corroborated by another study where subjects completed an 8-rep max squat with and without a belt. Despite squatting with a balloon catheter inserted about 10 centimeters into their rectums to measure the intra-abdominal pressure, the subjects still tended to move the final reps faster when wearing a belt when compared to not wearing a belt. And wearing a belt also seems to reduce the difficulty of performing a lift. In a recent study, subjects deadlifted about 80% of their 1-rep max for one repetition with and without a belt. While the time to complete the rep was similar in both conditions, the subject's rate of perceived exertion, so their RPE, was an average of 2 points lower when wearing a belt than going beltless. Of course, not all of the evidence is perfect here. One study where individuals deadlifted 90% of their one rep max with and without a belt showed no change in velocity or ground reactive forces. Overall, it seems like wearing a belt tends to improve lifting performance to some degree, likely through increasing the efficiency of force transfer through the trunk, plus some placebo-type effect. There is likely significant variability in how much a belt can help based on the movement itself, the individual, and other factors. Not to use a cop-out here, but more well-controlled data on how lifting belts alter 1RM or similar efforts in barbell training would definitely be helpful to strengthen confidence in these mechanisms and conclusions. But anecdotally, most, but certainly not all, people do seem to lift more weight in most exercises when wearing a belt. As with most things concerning humans, of course, individual differences are the norm. Now, as far as how to pick a belt, most high-quality belts are made of leather that, depending on the thickness, may be sandwiched between two layers of suede. Many different sizes of belts are available, and personal preference supersedes any particular recommendation that I could make. That said, most general strength trainees will prefer a 10 millimeter thick, 4-inch wide, single prong belt. That's pretty much the standard. Now, for competitive powerlifters or those who are looking for the maximum support, a 13 millimeter thick belt may be preferred, again, in a 4-inch wide thickness. And that applies even for those with relatively short torsos. I have not seen a 2.5 or 3-inch belt make much of a difference in someone's comfort or performance, though I do know some people who have been led to believe that. For Olympic weightlifters, a 6.5 millimeter thick belt is a common choice, and for CrossFit, some individuals prefer a nylon belt when the workout involves some sort of heavier lifting component. For pure strength training, however, I would not recommend these. And lastly, a brief word about tapered belts. Now, these are common. I think most people who use a tapered belt either got them off Amazon or some similar sort of vendor without maybe having a lot of information on the front end, or in bodybuilding, these things are kind of conventionally used for unknown reasons. I don't think I can make a good case for buying a tapered belt outside of it being someone's personal preference, in which case, hey, you do you. Similarly, padded belts are a thing where the back part of the belt is padded. Again, I see no reason to use these things, but again, if somebody prefers this for some reason, I guess that's fine. It just would not be my first choice. Now, when it comes to sizing, it is suggested that the individual measures their waist circumference and selects a size where the waist measurement falls near the middle of the sizing range for a particular manufacturer. And speaking of manufacturers, there are many different belt manufacturers out there that are making high-quality belts at different price points. We recommend one from either Pioneer, which is General Leathercraft, or SBD. Again, all that stuff's linked in the description. As far as when to use the belt, again, this is mostly personal preference. I think I could make a case for those trying to maximize performance. Lifting belts should be used for the highest priority exercises in the program, which are typically the heaviest exercises performed. Again, a lifting belt is not required for strength training, but it probably helps people lift more weight and is a good tool to have in most people's gym bag. All right, so that's the story on belts. Let's move on to knee sleeves. Knee sleeves are common gym accessories worn by competitive lifters or athletes using strength training for sport and even recreational gym goers in an effort to reduce the risk of injury and knee pain while also maybe improving performance. Let's address all of those things. But before, like, what even are knee sleeves? What classifies something as a knee sleeve? Now, a number of different knee braces have been developed over the course of history, with the oldest knee brace, which was made from cloth and wood, coming from the 4th dynasty in Egypt, about 2500 BC. Knee sleeves are a specific type of knee brace that are differentiated by the materials used, the amount of support offered, and their clinical use. Now, recently, a review in the leading orthopedic surgery journal described a number of different categories of knee braces. There's a prophylactic knee brace, there are functional knee braces, there are unloader braces, patellofemoral braces, rehabilitative braces, and knee sleeves. The utility of each different type of knee brace is beyond the scope of this podcast. However, the use of both knee sleeves and knee wraps are common in resistance training, so let's focus on those. Now, knee wraps are made from woven elastic materials that are wrapped tightly around the knee. During the descent of the squat, the knee wraps store elastic energy as the knee flexes or bends, which is then applied during the upwards phase when the knees are extending. As a result of this energy being transferred, most people will squat more weight with knee wraps, and this tends to correlate with a longer knee wrap or a more tightly wrapped knee wrap. The technical rules in competitive powerlifting typically set limits on a knee wrap's maximum width, maximum length, and again, longer, wider wraps are typically more supportive. For example, the International Powerlifting Federation, the IPF, allows a maximum length of 2 meters and a width of 8 centimeters for knee wraps. In contrast, knee sleeves are made from neoprene or a similar elastic material that do not provide structural support or store appreciable amounts of elastic energy with knee flexion during the descent of the squat, for example. Rather than being wrapped around the knee, they are a hollow cylinder that are pulled over the knee joint. There are also technical rules regarding the use of knee sleeves in competition. The IPF, again the International Powerlifting Federation, allows knee sleeves to have a maximum thickness of 7 millimeters and maximum length of 30 centimeters, but they can't have any additional wraps, Velcro, padding, or supportive devices. As far as how knee sleeves work, well, due to their construction, knee sleeves do not provide structural support. Instead, it is thought that knee sleeves work primarily by offering compression, warmth, and perhaps some sort of feedback on joint position, which is also known as proprioception. Now, these mechanisms are reasonable hypotheses for how knee sleeves work, but more research is needed to feel confident about them. So let's look at some research on outcomes to see, hey, do knee sleeves actually even work? Now, with respect to pain and injury risk, unfortunately, there's not much data on knee sleeves and injury risk reduction, especially as it pertains to exercise. If forced to speculate, I think it's unlikely that knee sleeves alter the incidence of knee injury during activity or exercise. And this is similar to the data we just discussed regarding the use of lifting belts and the incidence of low back pain, where again, multiple studies across multiple different industries repeatedly found the same thing. Belts do not reliably reduce the risk of low back injury, lost or restricted work days, or workmen's compensation claims due to low back injury. But with respect to pain, knee sleeves do appear to have some evidence for improving the symptoms of osteoarthritis, which is one of the most common disabling conditions encountered in medical practice. Now, patients with knee osteoarthritis commonly show deficits in quadriceps muscle strength, which correlates well with both function and pain. In those with knee pain secondary to osteoarthritis, knee sleeves have been shown to reduce pain severity, improve knee stability, and increase the individual's ability to participate in exercise, which is important to managing the condition. The more they can exercise in general, the better their symptom control and better their trajectory is. Now, with respect to strength, knee sleeves do not appear to change squat mechanics significantly, but they do appear to have a rather modest effect on maximal strength performance in the squat based on the available evidence. Additionally, the use of knee sleeves tends to improve subjective ratings of comfort and stability compared to bare knees, while also adding about 3% to a squat 1RM in trained subjects compared to a placebo knee sleeve, which is very loose and offered no compression. Wearing an even tighter knee sleeve when studied did not actually increase 1RM performance. This is actually an interesting study. So they used SBD knee sleeves, and in one of the interventions, they used the size guide that SBD provided to get the correct, quote-unquote, knee sleeve for the participants in the study. And then in the other arm of the intervention, these same folks used one size down from that, and there was really no difference in performance. To me, that suggests that squeezing into a smaller size knee sleeve is probably not as important as the amount of energy that you waste getting that knee sleeve on. Lastly, it should be noted that not all studies on knee sleeves and squat performance show an improvement, though none of them show harm to performance either. As far as choosing a knee sleeve, it's best, in our opinion, to use the manufacturer's recommended sizing and measuring technique. We would not recommend sizing down since there's little apparent benefit to performance, but they do tend to be a lot harder to put on. Ultimately, like the belt thing, it's personal preference. So here's my sort of rundown on picking a knee sleeve, both size and manufacturer. For those interested in maximal support, so like powerlifting, strength training, we recommend a 7mm thick knee sleeve like the SBD knee sleeves. Though there are other brands like Stoic and A7 we also feel like are good choices. There's this new generation of knee sleeves that are much stiffer and much more difficult to put on, but I am not convinced that those actually improve performance. In fact, I think they just kind of waste a bunch of energy by people putting them on. However, there might be this sort of placebo-mediated effect that people feel more comfortable, feel stronger, and ultimately perform better with the tighter knee sleeve, but again, that's just speculation. For those who still want a good amount of support but who want an easier knee sleeve to put on, it's really hard to beat the classic Ray-Ban 7mm knee sleeve. Those actually only used to be available in this like baby blue color, but now there are different colorways, so if matching is important to you, you have some options now. And for those who want some support with a really super easy to put on knee sleeve, it's not quite as stiff of a knee sleeve as the SBD ones or the 7mm thick Ray-Ban knee sleeves we just talked about, we do recommend a 5mm thick knee sleeve from SBD, Ray-Ban, or similar. They all make them. And this is actually what I got my dad to use because, again, I can't imagine him fighting a stiff knee sleeve before he goes to squat. I'm just happy he's squatting and he wants a knee sleeve. I'm going to get him something that's easy to put on. Now, my personal preference is to use a 7mm knee sleeve, just the stiff one that SBD makes. That's, you know, I'm willing to kind of fight it to get on a little bit. It's like an acceptable level of hardness to put on, and I feel like it gives me some good support. I prefer using those, although not this last meet that I did, but the meet before that, I guess the knee sleeves that I brought were 5mm thick, and I didn't know. And I still squatted 616, 280 kilos, which is pretty good for me. So ultimately, I don't think it matters that much. I think it's just personal preference, again, similar to the belt thing that we talked about. As far as when to wear a knee sleeve, we get this question all the time. When should I wear my knee sleeves? When should I not? It's probably best used for squats and squat pattern type movements. So things like the leg press, split squats, lunges, and so on. They can also be helpful for higher velocity movements that are sometimes performed in training, so like Olympic lifts or various strongman exercises. But again, wearing them is mostly personal preference that should probably boil down to the simple question. Does wearing the knee sleeve allow training this exercise to be more productive than not wearing a knee sleeve? In this case, productive means with less pain, fear of movement, being able to train with more volume, and at the appropriate intensity. While some people do wear knee sleeves during deadlifts, we do not routinely recommend this unless somebody has knee pain during deadlifts, which is relatively rare, but hey, you're going to come across that. With proper deadlift mechanics, the problem is that the knee sleeves tend to get in the way of the bar path and can compromise efficiency. Again, this might be worth it for somebody who has active knee pain, and that's the only way they're going to do some sort of deadlift-type movement, right? But yeah, if the bar is being, you know, kind of dragged up the legs, in contact with the legs, it can get hung up on the bottom part of the knee sleeve, which, 0 out of 10, would not recommend. As a last comment on when to wear knee sleeves, and I should be clear, I do not think it matters. It's mostly personal preference, but people want a guide or a knee sleeve use protocol. Here we go. If you're on the fence about it, a good rule of thumb is that if the movement is relatively light and or involves a tempo component and or can be performed pain-free and or is one-sided or unilateral, well, the knee sleeves can probably stay in the bag. Anything else? Hey, put them on. Now, when we return from this break, we'll discuss both wrist wraps and ammonia. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. You can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Now, Acorns is an investment platform, also have a bunch of educational tools on their website. I thought they had a pretty good product, so thought I would let them sponsor our podcast. They make it easy to automatically start saving and investing for the future. You don't actually need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can start with just your spare change. With Roundups, that's a program that they have to round up any purchase made from a linked account, debit or credit card to the next dollar, and that goes into your retirement or investment account. They also have Acorns Early, which is an investment account for kids. And they recommend an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head over to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first three-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. so you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Let's continue our discussion about lifting equipment by talking about wrist wraps. Now, wrist wraps are a type of supportive equipment commonly used by competitive and recreational lifters alike to increase wrist stability, grip strength, and reduce wrist pain when lifting. So wrist wraps encircle the wrist to reinforce the wrist joint via compression of the joint. They are typically made from a woven elastic material covered by polyester and/or cotton and are secured by Velcro in order to make them easy to put on and easy to take off between sets. For completeness, athletic tape and other forms of medical crepe or bandage are also a type of wrist wrap, though they are typically left on for the duration of the workout or activity. Now, wrist wraps should not be confused with wrist straps, which are pieces of woven fabric that are looped around the wrist that are also looped around the barbell, dumbbell, or other implement to help secure the lifter's grip. Lifters may use wrist straps in a number of different settings like high repetition or heavy deadlifts, rowing or pulling exercises, or if an individual has a torn callus or skin injury of the hand, or when the grip is otherwise fatigued. In general, wrist straps help lifters lift more weight and complete more reps if their grip is fatigued or otherwise a limiting factor. But back to wrist wraps, let's talk about how they work. Now, wrist wraps are often said to improve lifting performance by increasing stability of the wrist and improving grip strength, while simultaneously reducing the risk of wrist injury and/or pain. Let's explore this a bit further by looking at some research. All right, first up, we're going to talk about grip strength, which is a measurement of force created by the muscles in the hand. Those are intrinsic hand muscles, and the forearm. Those are extrinsic hand muscles. And these work together to produce a strong grip. Now, studies looking at grip strength as measured by a handheld device that measures force production, it's called a hand grip dynamometer, show that wrist wraps do not reliably change grip strength compared to no wrap, regardless if they're of a flexible material, stiff material, or even if they're made from athletic tape. Now, there are less than a handful of studies that have looked at dynamic strength performance in lifting tasks like the squat and the bench press when wearing wrist wraps, but we can talk about those briefly. One recent study surveyed 70 competitive powerlifters about wrist wrap use and found that 71% used wrist wraps during the squat, whereas about 89% used wrist wraps for the bench press. Importantly, there was no correlation between strength performance and wrist wrap use. The majority of lifters used a stiff wrap, measuring 60 to 99 centimeters in length during the bench press, and a flexible wrap measuring 60 to 99 centimeters or over 100 centimeters in the squat. I thought that was interesting because most lifters I know are not carrying around multiple types of wrist wraps for training, so that discrepancy was interesting to me, but that's what this one rather small survey tended to find. Now, in a head-to-head comparison, 9 men and 9 women tested their one rep max bench press with no wrap, a flexible wrap, or a stiff wrist wrap to see if there were any performance differences. There were no significant differences in 1RM performance between wearing any of the wraps compared to wearing no wrap. Now, another way that wrist wraps are said to work is to improve wrist stability. Despite little evidence showing improved strength performance when wearing wrist wraps, studies measuring a subjective sense of, quote, wrist stability routinely find benefits to wearing wrist wraps. There's also evidence that wrist wraps may improve an individual's ability to sense the position of the wrist, perhaps leading to improved stability. Now, I will say that testing wrist stability and position sense are both a little murky with respect to the reliability of measurement, at least as far as my interpretation of these studies go, but I do think it's reasonable to conclude that some people probably feel more stable with a wrist wrap on. Now, let's talk about injury and pain with respect to using a wrist wrap. Nearly half of powerlifting injuries are associated with the bench press, and a large number of CrossFit-related injuries occur in the wrist, so it's thought that maybe a supportive wrist wrap could be of use at reducing the risk of injury and certainly pain. Some data suggests that those with wrist pain have improved range of motion and decreased pain during activity when using a wrist wrap. However, the relationship between wrist wrap use and injury in barbell or other sports has not been studied at this time. From an injury and pain management standpoint, to me, wrist wraps are probably useful in those who have current wrist pain during exercise, but they probably don't reduce the risk of injury. Again, they can be a useful training aid for those with active wrist pain. As far as how or when to use wrist wraps, the use of wrist wraps during training and competition is mostly a matter of personal preference. Hopefully you're catching on to a theme here. Pretty much the use of all this stuff is whenever you want. Now, commonly, lifters will use wrist wraps during the bench press, the overhead press, and variations of these lifts, though some will also use them on other lifts that load the wrists, like the back squat, front squat, cleans, snatches, and so on. As a general guideline, we recommend using wrist wraps as needed. Using myself as a practical example, I spent the majority of my training career using wrist wraps on heavy squats, bench presses, and overhead presses. I would typically put them on near the end of my warm-up sets so that the feel of the movement didn't change as I started my heavier working sets. That said, I stopped using them a few years ago after a non-gym-related injury to my shoulder. Since then, I've actually set a new personal record on my squat and bench press, suggesting again that this is mostly personal preference. I just don't prefer to use them anymore for no other reason that I didn't use them during my rehab phase and haven't found the need to use them. And so as a competitive powerlifter, one of the things that we kind of think about while we're, you know, getting ready to go out on the platform is, when should I put my wrist wraps on? Because you don't want to be sitting there with a really tight wrist wrap for an extended period of time. At least I don't anyway. One final note for competitors, wrist wraps are legal to use in competition for most barbell sports like powerlifting, Olympic weightlifting, and strongman, though different sanctioning bodies have their own technical specifications that must be adhered to for the wrist wrap itself. Most powerlifting organizations publish the list of approved equipment periodically. It's updated. Make sure that your equipment is approved prior to showing up for a meet. That's the last thing you want, is to be, you know, all set up for a meet. You go to the meet, do technical inspection, and they say, hey, you can't use these wrist wraps. At that point, you're forced to buy a new set of wrist wraps or, you know, just go raw. As far as how to pick a wrist wrap, well, wrist wraps come in different lengths and levels of support. To be clear, the correct wrap is up to a lifter's personal preference. Again, you should be noticing a theme here. But we do have a number of recommendations based on the type of lifting you do and tastes. For general strength training that includes heavy squats, bench presses, and overhead work, we recommend a medium length, so about 60 centimeter, flexible wrist wrap, such as that from SBD. Again, there are other manufacturers, although I will say, not every manufacturer has figured out how to make a left and right-sided wrist wrap, and using two left-sided wrist wraps, as one very popular manufacturer continues to put out, is less than ideal. In any case, this wrap will also work for competitive powerlifters who prefer a flexible wrist wrap that isn't too bulky. Now, for competitive powerlifters looking for the maximum support during training and competition, or strongman competitors who really want something stiff around their wrist, the medium or large, that refers to the length of the wrist wrap in this particular case, but the medium or large stiff wrist wraps from SBD would be a good choice. Again, anecdotal experience here, I've actually had my 1 meter long SBD wrist wraps from 2014, so that's 10 years now. Most of the time, particularly with other manufacturers, the Velcro would fail. And again, I was using these pretty diligently up until about a year and a half or 2 years ago. So I've been very impressed with their quality from that perspective, and I love the stiff wrist wrap. On the other hand, Austin actually purchased a pair, this must have been 4 or 5 years ago, and I think he used them for one or two workouts and hasn't used them since. He just doesn't like them. So again, use of wrist wrap, period, is personal preference. The length, like size, and the stiffness, again, is also personal preference. I do think that it can be useful to have a wrist wrap in the bag, especially if you deal with wrist pain from time to time. And again, I think if you're like not a habitual user of wrist wraps, having a more flexible wrap that's either small or medium length is probably a good idea to have in the gym bag. Now, for Olympic weightlifting or for those doing CrossFit, I've done both, and my personal preference is to get something even more flexible from Rogue. They actually have a number of kind of application-specific wrist wraps. I've linked, again, all of that in the show notes below. All right, finally, let's talk about ammonia and smelling salts. Okay, ammonia inhalants, or quote, smelling salts, are any number of preparations containing ammonium carbonate. Now, when combined into a liquid, which are widely available on the internet, smelling salts are typically combinations of ammonium carbonate, alcohol, and water. So a more accurate term for this mixture is aromatic spirits of ammonia, but we'll use the more common term smelling salt for ease of understanding. All right, so how are smelling salts used? Well, historically, smelling salts were used to prevent and sometimes treat fainting, dizziness, and lightheadedness. Some older medical texts dating back to the 19th century describe using smelling salts to, quote, excite respiration when resuscitating a patient. Now, in sport, smelling salts have been used widely before a high-intensity effort, such as a 1RM squat, bench press, or deadlift, and powerlifting. And it's not clear how many athletes use these smelling salts, but anecdotally, I estimate about half of powerlifters competing at a meet use them, while other barbell sport athletes in Olympic weightlifting and CrossFit use them far less frequently. As far as how smelling salts work, well, smelling salts and other ammonia inhalants are said to work by inhaled ammonia acting as an irritant on the nose and lungs, thereby triggering an inhalation reflex, increased blood flow to the brain, and increased heart rate. Together, the resulting physiology is said to increase alertness and potentially performance. Now, interestingly, a number of studies have looked at whether or not using smelling salts improved strength performance. Let's go through them briefly. In one study, smelling salts did not improve the repetitions completed to failure at 85% of a 1RM in a squat and a bench press. Another study found that smelling salts did not improve force production on an isometric mid-thigh pull. Another study found that smelling salts did not result in a higher counter-movement jump or increased force production on an isometric mid-thigh pull compared to placebo. In one study, 14 untrained men perceived that their performance went up on hand grip strength, quadriceps strength testing, and jumping. However, there was no actual improvement compared to placebo. Another study in 10 trained college-aged adults, so these all had between 1.4 to 2 times body weight deadlifts, deadlift 1RM was not improved with ammonia inhalant compared to placebo. Now, this is an interesting study. They actually took 10 pro golfers and they tested using an ammonia inhalant on the frequency of making a 3-meter putt. The ammonia inhalant reduced their make percentage from 67.75% to 52.5%, though this was not statistically significant. So all of the studies so far, basically no improvement in objective performance, although one study found a subjective improvement in performance. This is the one study I could find that actually showed an improvement in performance using an ammonia inhalant. Now, this study was done in 10 trained college-age men, and they completed a simulated football game. And then they used an ammonia inhalant before this Wingate anaerobic power test. This is like you get on one of those exercise bikes that you might have seen in an exercise science lab. It's got like a weighted flywheel that can be adjusted and you pedal like crazy for a set period of time. Well, yeah, they used an ammonia inhalant before that. And they found that compared to placebo, there was an increase in both peak power that was found on that test and mean power. So performance actually went up a little bit. So overall, it seems that smelling salts and other ammonia inhalants do not provide a huge boost to performance for strength or golf, apparently. It is true that most of these studies are quite small and studied individuals who had not previously used smelling salts, which may have affected the results. While admittedly speculative, it does seem possible that those who prefer to use smelling salts prior to a heavy effort may see a benefit, whereas those who don't prefer them or who haven't used them before to form an opinion are more likely to have variable results. Overall, I think it's mostly a matter of personal preference here. I prefer to use ammonia inhalants before deadlifts at powerlifting meets, and because I know I like them, I probably am placeboing myself into having increased performance, but that's just me. All right, so we talked about the limited benefits that are seen with using a smelling salt or other ammonia inhalant. But are there any risks associated to using these things? So ammonia inhalants are available for sale over the counter in the United States, making them readily available. Fortunately, there are relatively few risks associated with smelling salts when used as directed, which is basically holding the activated capsule or solution about 15 centimeters away from the nose and inhaling it for a short period of time. Now, there have been at least 2 case reports of smelling salt-related complications in sport. In one, a young female powerlifter had an allergic reaction after using an ammonia inhalant before a national record deadlift attempt. She required immediate medical attention, went to the hospital, but after that, all of her symptoms subsequently resolved when she was treated for this allergic reaction. In another instance, a 14-year-old boy collapsed during a running drill. Now, he was administered an ammonia inhalant repeatedly before being transferred to a hospital where, unfortunately, he subsequently passed away. It was later found out that the boy had sickle cell trait, which was thought to be exacerbated by repeated ammonia inhalant administration. As far as when to use smelling salts in general, smelling salts and other ammonia inhalants should be reserved for competition, one rep max tests, and similar efforts in individuals who prefer use of ammonia inhalants. We do not recommend using ammonia inhalants or smelling salts for the first time at a competition without some sort of previous testing to see how it affects the individual. Instead, a trial run may be performed in training prior to a heavy effort as a test just to figure out, hey, do I like these things or not? One note for competitors, some organizations have rules around where athletes can use smelling salts. For example, the IPF, again, International Powerlifting Federation, requires athletes to use smelling salts out of view of the audience. Just a little word to the wise there. All right, that's a wrap on our discussion on lifting equipment. Again, all of the stuff we talked about is linked in the show notes below. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend and leave us a 5-star review. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.